You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's podcast is sponsored by Nadex. Want to try day trading the markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, now you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. It's the one thing that none of us ever want to experience and most of us never want to talk about. And yet, for every living creature, it is the one certainty. Death, the grim reaper, the big sleep, biting the dust, taking a dirt nap, kicking the can, or buying the farm. By any name, it is unavoidable, and yet we still try. Dot-com billionaires like Jeff Bezos throw their fortunes at sometimes shaky science in a desperate effort to extend their own expiration dates. The rules of polite society dictate that the very subject of death is awkward and taboo. Popular culture portrays it as something horrific, the worst imaginable outcome. And an entire industry has perfected the art of disposing the recently deceased before we the living can even notice they're gone. But my guest today says our aversion to death is unwarranted and actually unhealthy to those trying to cope with the loss. What's more, she says America's squeamishness over all things death-related is almost unique in the world compared to other countries that not only accept it, but celebrate it. And she's at the forefront of a movement to change how the U.S. funeral industry and the American public approach death and mourning. Caitlin Doty is the happy-go-lucky mortician behind the alternative funeral home called Undertaking LA, and she's the founder of the Order of the Good Death, a nonprofit that seeks to foster a more death-informed society. This best-selling author has just written her second book, titled From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find Good Death. And today she joins me on the podcast to reveal how America's funeral industrial complex overcharges and overregulates how we say goodbye to our loved ones, and how funerals went from private family affairs to big business in just a century. She shares how villagers in Indonesia sleep, eat, and interact with their deceased on a daily basis, and how high-tech innovations are revolutionizing how the dearly departed are honored in Japan. She tells of a community in Colorado that forgoes the boring funeral home cremation in favor of an old-fashioned funeral pyre, and a green advocate in North Carolina who wants to compost your corpse. She says it's all part of a movement to give families more options in how they say goodbye, and she wants you to know your rights when dealing with the loss of a loved one. Plus, she tells me what a dead body smells like and whether or not I can have a Viking funeral. coming up with Caitlin Doty in just a moment. Caitlin Doty is a mortician, activist, and self-described funeral industry rabble-rouser known for advocating death acceptance and the reform of Western funeral industry practices. She's the owner and proprietor of her own alternative funeral home, Undertaking LA, and she's the founder of the Order of the Good Death, an inclusive community of funeral industry professionals, academics, as well as artists who advocate for a more death-informed society. She's also the creator and the host of the popular web series Ask a Mortician, which has garnered over 17 million views on YouTube, and author of the best-selling book Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. Caitlin Doty has just completed her second book, titled From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find Good Death. Caitlin, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, this was a very entertaining and eye-opening book. You know, it's funny how we spend our whole lives trying to cheat the inevitable. You talk at length about how our society has done everything we can to avoid death and to push it out of sight. Is it more than a coincidence that you're releasing this book during the only time of the year, really, when people in America actually think about death, October?
Are you talking about Halloween?
Yes.
It's so interesting. People, it doesn't matter when I put out the book, people will say, okay, we're holding the publicity until October 29th or
really?
October 31st. And it's like, ugh, I might as well just put out the book on October 31st.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I do talking about death and talking about mortality and our relationship to mortality, that doesn't have a huge amount to do with Halloween. But it's
right.
So interesting that that's really our only reference point for it in the United States. And the fact that, you know, I do like Halloween. The border between the living and the dead is thinned. You can interact with mortality in a mm-hmm. way that you might not normally be able to, even if you're the type of person who's like, ew, I would never talk about death. I would never do anything about death. But I'm a slutty ghost. You know, okay, well, if that's your entry level to death and the idea of death, we welcome you and we hope that's a gateway drug for you to go deeper into addressing your own mortality.
Yeah, well, I find it fascinating how Americans' attitudes toward death and funerals have changed over the past 100 years or so. We were just talking right before we started, kind of the dirty little secret that I don't think my listeners know, this has probably never come up, is that we actually record this. My studio is in an old 100-year-old funeral home. In the old days, people would lay grandpa out in the parlor and bury him in the backyard or a churchyard, but then at some point, cemeteries were pushed to the outskirts of cities, and this relatively new idea of funeral homes came about that recreated the home funeral setting in a mortuary, even calling them funeral parlors, while at the same time, the parlor in your home suddenly became the quote-unquote living room. How have we gone in such a short period of time from having very intimate family affairs to outsourcing our loved ones the moment they expire?
That's a really great, succinct description you gave, and that's absolutely what's happened, and it's remarkable how quickly it's happened. So really, if you know what embalming is the chemical preservation of the dead body. And in America, that started during the Civil War. It was Northerners going down to fight in the South, dying on the battlefield, and families wanting to preserve their bodies to bring them back up north, which is a totally reasonable desire. Families took care of the bodies and they wanted to see their fallen sons once more. But what happened is that it very quickly became a business, even after the war ended. Chemical companies would travel around the United States selling their embalming chemicals and selling these workshops for people to learn how to be embalmers. And then it became, okay, well, I'm a professional. And I'm going to chemically preserve this dead body, and you, the family, are no longer qualified
to do so. You've got to bring your body in. You've got to go to the professionals. And it was about the same time that hospitals were becoming professionalized. People weren't dying at home anymore. Slaughterhouses were becoming centralized. People weren't killing their own animals anymore. So in one fell swoop, death, which was such an intimate part of our lives, was removed from our society. And that's why we have this, you know, fast forward 100 years, that's why we have this distant, strained, only at Halloween relationship with death today.
And this book, I guess, is just one cog in a movement that you're very much a part of to reject or at least offer alternatives to the funeral industrial complex. What are your biggest problems with modern commercial funeral homes?
We call ourselves the death positive movement, and that doesn't mean your mom died. You should just get over it and feel really positive about it. That's not what that means at all. What we mean is it's okay to be interested in death. It's okay to be interested in these histories and rituals and stories. It's not morbid or wrong to think that we have a problem with the way that we do things. And my biggest problem with the industry is, I explained a little bit about embalming, most people have no idea that it's not legally required at all to embalm their loved one, and that you can politely decline at the funeral home. But some funeral directors, not even trying to, they may not even know this themselves, but they'll tell the family, well, we'd love to not embalm it, but unfortunately it really is the law, it really is the regulations, and that's just not true. So there's all sorts of things, you know, at a cemetery, they put big concrete vaults around the caskets, and they'll tell families, well, it is a requirement that we do that. It's not. It's their personal requirement. It's completely legal. It's their policy. Because they want to make it easier to landscape the grass. Mm-hmm. So, which is totally true. I'm not making that up. And so, yeah, you can not chemically embalm a body. You can just dig a small, shallow hole in the ground and wrap the body in a beautiful shroud and some flowers and put the dirt on yourself as a family. That's all totally legal. But as you said, the funeral industrial complex doesn't want you to know that. And I'm not claiming it's some vast conspiracy. They've just been doing it that way for so long. A lot of them believe it, that that is the only way to do it. But there's just people now who say, wait a minute, I want to be more involved than that. I want more access to spearheading this myself. This was my mom. I don't want to just hand her over to someone else when I die.
Yeah, and you talk about natural funerals where they just put you in a shroud and then lower you into the grave without a casket or any enclosure. There's even someone who's modernizing it and trying to go green with burials and trying to compost corpses. Is there something of a libertarian revolt going on against this commercial funeral industry right now?
There absolutely is. And what's fascinating about this is it's such strange bedfellows, because it's really these older, very liberal, almost hippie types who want the natural burial. And their biggest allies are the libertarians, because it's this group saying, hey, you know, and the ones who are most responsible for actually changing the laws in America are the libertarian groups and libertarian lawyers, because they're saying, hey, wait a second, why is the American funeral industry so heavily regulated to benefit these specific companies that young people can't enter the funeral industry? There's a concept called ready to embalm, which is my least favorite thing in the world. And what it is, I believe it's 29 states that have this, and it requires you, even if you don't intend to offer embalming at your funeral home at all, you have to be, quote, ready to embalm at any time, like a body's going to fall from the sky and you've like got to emergency chemically preserve it. And you have to pay the hundreds of thousands of dollars it requires to set up that kind of facility, even if it's not something you're going to offer at all. So it's impossible. Wow. The barrier to entry for a young funeral director or a minority funeral director or an immigrant funeral director is so high that it's just impossible. And one of the keystone libertarian cases was a group of monks in the South that after Hurricane Katrina was building these beautiful, simple wooden caskets and trying to sell them. And the funeral board went, no, excuse me, you can't. You're not a funeral director. You're not licensed. You can't sell caskets. And they came in and sued and said, wait a second, yes we can. This is a simple casket. It's not, you know, we're not talking about now we're handling bodies or we're in charge of this. All we want to do is sell simple caskets, but the funeral lobby is so strong that they weren't letting them do it.
And didn't you say, I think this also kind of goes into some religious liberty territories, because Muslims and Jews don't believe in embalming. They still have to go through all this and have the embalming equipment available?
Yes. So
even though they're never going to use
that. So if you're a Muslim person and there's a big Muslim presence in your community and you're trying to open that funeral home, and they don't believe, they believe in burying the body very quickly with no invasive draining of the blood, like Judaism, and just a simple burial. And the fact that you would say, okay, you have to go to 2 years to a mortuary school to learn the ins and outs of embalming for something you're never going to offer, one, and two, isn't even legally required. What are you guys doing? They have such a specific industry and model that they're trying to preserve that, and less and less people want it. Frankly, people don't want embalming anymore. Right. People don't want these big funerals anymore. They're too expensive and they just don't reflect. I'm not saying it's bad if you want that. Go ahead. It's certainly available to you. But it's just not reflecting what people really want anymore, in my opinion, and just from what I hear doing this work.
It almost reflects kind of where millennials are going in general, moving away from the ownership society, not wanting to have a burial plot reserved for you, not wanting to have a big production and all that. You say that apparently cremation as a whole is on the rise. Now, how is the funeral industrial complex going to adjust to this? Because doesn't their whole business model revolve around selling burial plots and upselling you on the super deluxe titanium casket and that kind of thing?
It does. And they, for years, cremation has been rising for years, and they've seen the slow creep coming toward them. And you know, cremation has been around for so long, but they still go, oh, it's coming. What are we going to do? And it's like, well, adjust your model. Figure it out. Don't spend so much money on overhead and these really expensive casket rooms and hearses to try and convince people this is what they have to do, because they don't want that. They want greener options. They want less expensive options. And these traditional funeral homes are not going to survive. We just went over 50% at cremation, where now more people are cremated than buried.
Really?
And we have new technology like alkaline hydrolysis or aquamation, which dissolves the body with high heat water as opposed to flame. And more people want that. It's just going to continue moving away from this quote unquote traditional or conventional model. And funeral directors, if they really want what's best for their families and the people they're working with, have to face that, have to face some hard truths in this area.
There's one place where cremation is apparently even more popular right now. 99% of Japanese are cremated, not buried. Is that a function of the land shortage, or what's behind that?
There's a lot of cultural reasons behind that. At the beginning of the 20th century, they still had people being buried as well. But it is, I actually, when I was there in Japan for this book, there was a conversation that I had with a priest. And he made fun of the way that Americans say, oh, I don't know about cemeteries. We're running out of land. And he's like, excuse me, we're the ones who don't have enough land to do this. You have more than enough land in America. Have you ever flown over the Midwest? You could put a cemetery anywhere. And that's true. We act like we don't have any land for cemeteries. But in Japan, they really don't have land. And Europe is like that as well. So for years, places in Europe and Japan have had much higher cremation rates than America has. We've gotten away for a long time with keeping the burial rate high because of the industry and because of the land that we have.
You know, here in the U.S., we have this idea of burial in perpetuity. Apparently, that's not that common outside the U.S. How does that work elsewhere, like in Europe?
There, I was actually on the phone with a reporter from Germany yesterday, and we were talking about this, and she was like, wait a second, are you saying that when you get a grave, you just get it forever? And she just couldn't wrap her mind around that. And I was like, well, here's the thing. When I tell people about what happens in Europe, which is that when your body goes into a grave, you're essentially renting that grave. Your body is a short-term renter. It has a sublease on this apartment grave. And, you know, what depends on 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, your time is up after you've decomposed, and they remove your bones and they put it into a larger, you know, either like a charnel house or a larger grave, and somebody else gets your spot. And they do this everywhere in Europe. And one place that I visited in Spain, they took me to the top of the hill and opened this manhole cover, and I got to stick my head down the manhole cover in the hill, and it was bags of bones and bags, you know, and just piles of bones and ash. And that's where everybody had gone in after they had spent their time in the grave. And it's fascinating because we have such an idea here of this is my special grave,
right?
And I will be here forever and ever and ever. And that is a part of the American death tradition, and I don't think we're going to be changing that anytime soon. But if we're really concerned about land and we still want to be buried, this is an option that everywhere else has been doing for forever.
Yeah, but, you know, I think in America we have such a stigma against the concept of a mass grave. We identify the mass grave with genocide.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's one of the problems. But, you know, they have that in Europe too. Mm-hmm. They have that idea, but it's still somehow they've been able to. And I really think, well, here's the thing too, though. In America, only 30 years ago, cremation was the devil's work. Cremation was, you know, setting up. There was associations with the Holocaust, associations with hell for Christians, you know, associations with all of these very dark things. But if it's around a long time and it's seen as a less expensive option, as a more eco-friendly option, eventually people are going to change their minds about it, and the dialogue is going to change about it. So I'm not pushing for, you know, mass graves at this point, but or communal graves at this point. But, you know, anything is possible in the future of death. Cultures change their death traditions all the time.
Yeah. And in talking about cremation and these alternatives to conventional funerals, I touched upon earlier this small community in Colorado that is apparently the only place in America where people are allowed to cremate their loved ones in a funeral pyre, which I guess that's a ritual that goes back at least to the Roman times, right? What's the difference between a funeral pyre and conventional or commercial cremation?
So it's this amazing community in Colorado, and it's actually the only open-air funeral pyre in the Western world entirely. And it's this little community that has taken over death care. They've wrenched it away from the funeral homes, and they do it themselves in their community. When someone dies, they come to your house and prepare the body in the home. Wow. And then they take, at dawn, you know, 2 days later, they take the body up and they put it on this beautiful pyre, and the smoke twirls up into the air. And if you're a spiritual person, you can't help but think that, oh, this is the soul going up, and it's just gorgeous and out in nature. And it makes me so jealous and so sad as someone who has a funeral home in a big city like Los Angeles, because we have to take our families to this industrial crematory. Mm-hmm. And I love when people come in to what's called witness the cremation, because I think that's a powerful ritual to be present for that. So we do encourage people to do that. But man, I wish I could take them out under the sky and set their mother alight in this ancient way, as opposed to putting them in this big natural gas guzzling industrial machine in a warehouse. That's not my ideal. And I hope that we can really improve our crematories in America too, because as I said, more than 50% of us are doing it now. We don't have to be, it's like if everyone had to drive like a 1980 Dodge, you know, as opposed, like, no, we can do better than this. We can make this more beautiful. We can make this more comfortable.
Yeah, and this funeral pyre option is so popular, apparently, there's a huge demand for it that people are actually buying land in Crestone, Colorado, just so they can get a right to a funeral pyre.
Exactly. So they require that the community, you know, they be a part of the community to because mm-hmm. they can't. Hindus are calling them, Native Americans are calling mm-hmm. them, Buddhists are calling them, saying, hey, can we just come be cremated on your pyre? And they have to say no, unfortunately. So people are buying little plots of land or little houses in this rural Colorado area. There was a woman, I believe, who died of cancer pretty young, and she had bought a little piece of land, and her young daughter helped prepare her body, and they cremated her there, and it was quite beautiful. So, yeah, I understand. Wow. People, when they feel like they're not getting the death options that are really meaningful to them, whether because of their religion or the culture, it's really haunting and painful to know that you're not. It's like when someone dies in a plane crash and you're not able to recover their remains, mm-hmm. or someone dies in war and you're not able to recover them. There's just always this longing that something wasn't done that mm-hmm. needed to be done.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Caitlin Doty when we come back in just a moment. Warning, if you're drowning in debt you can't afford, do not let the credit card companies convince you that you have to pay it all back, because you don't. What the credit card companies don't want you to know is that there's actually a way to get debt-free without paying off your entire debt or going bankrupt. If you have $5,000 or more in credit card debt, you now have the right to let credit associates settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. They'll even show you how much money you could save. If you can't afford to pay off all your debt, don't let the credit card companies convince you that you have to. Call Credit Associates now for free information on how to get debt-free faster than you thought possible without debt consolidation or bankruptcy. Credit Associates depends on your success and offers a guarantee, so there's no risk. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. That's 1-800-500-0351. You give a number of examples of how around the world it's very common for the family to interact with the corpse, to wash and dress the body as part of the grieving process. One of the most interesting and amazing ones is this remote village in Indonesia where the corpse actually lives with the family, sometimes, I guess, for years before they put it to rest. How do they do that? Is it like Weekend at Bernie's, or what is that like?
You went there yourself.
I was like,
it's not like Weekend at Bernie's. Actually, it sort of is like Weekend at Bernie's, because what they do is when the person dies, they believe that the person is still alive. They have a fever. They're not quite dead yet, and they're still present somehow. And they mummify the body through – the old method is through teas and tanning and these old techniques. The modern way is just good old embalmers, formaldehyde, like we would use in the U.S. And the body lives in the home, and wow. they bring it food. They dress it. Sometimes they sleep in the same room as the body. And even going there, even with my many years of doing this job and being close to dead bodies – I was thinking, well, this is a little too far for me. But when you go there, it's just so normal. It doesn't, you know, we found out that we had been sleeping within 10 feet of a body the whole time we were there, and we just didn't know.
Where was it?
No. It was in the house right next door.
Oh, okay.
And we hadn't known. And then the last day they were like, okay, come in. And we visited the woman, and she had only been dead about 2 weeks, but she was beautiful. And she was wrapped in these beautiful cloths, and she looked very well preserved. And this culture also, they take the bodies out even after the burial happens, after the funeral happens and the burial happens. They bring the mummies out every 3 years to redress them. And they're taking pictures and putting it on Instagram. And it's just so, when you're there, though, I have to say it's beautiful. It's normal. It seems like, you know, a 4th of July picnic, basically. It's that level of like families coming together in a good old communal way to eat and mm-hmm. celebrate the dead and be with each other, and people come from out of town for this mummy gathering. And it's cool. It's so cool. And I don't think that Americans are ready for that. I'm not proposing this, just like I'm not proposing communal graves. But there's something to learn from, you know, in America, if mom dies and she's at home, she had a cancer, she's under hospice, mm-hmm. our immediate reaction is, holy crap, call the funeral home right now.
Right.
We got to get her out of here. This is an emergency. We're talking about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You can sit with your mom for an hour, for 2 hours, for 4 hours. You have that power, and just take the time to be with her. And the fact that we're so freaked out about it in America, and then you go to this rural place in Indonesia, and we're talking about years that people can interact with their dead. It's like, wow, we are obviously so wildly uptight about the dead body that, you know, we haven't gotten the memo that it's okay to be more comfortable with our dead.
Yeah, and I think one of the people that you encountered there said that he and his brother would even sleep with, I think, his grandpa or someone who was, you know, a mummy. They would wake him up and then dress him and prop him up, I guess, on a chair or up against the wall or something.
This was our guide. This was the gentleman who was with us the whole time and really got us into these, you know, amazing, unique scenarios. And we, you know, we asked him at some point, hey, is this something that you've ever had experience with? And he just casually was like, oh, yeah, no, we lived with my grandpa for like 7 years when my brother and I were younger. And I was like, oh, right. This is a guy that we'd gotten to know. And it's just this, like, you know, he's not, I guess that I keep saying normal because I think people's expectation mm-hmm. is like, you must be like psycho. You know, you must be like Norman Bates keeping mom in your house.
Yeah,
you know, you must be a twisted character of some sort.
Yeah, like, definitely,
nope,
in this culture.
These are real normal folk.
Now, not everything is steeped in tradition in the old ways. Modern day Japanese tend to be early adopters of all the hot technology. How has that translated to their funeral practices as well?
Japan, I think, is the model of what America could be because they not only still respect the dead body and want to interact with it and wash it and dress it and have those beautiful rituals, but they also welcome technology. Whereas in America, if you're a funeral director, it's like, oh, we have to get a Facebook page? I don't know about that. You know, that's their relationship with technology. Yeah. Where in Japan, they have, so for example, they have a columbarium, which is where you keep cremated remains or ashes. They have one right off the subway by the sumo stadium. And you go in on your lunch break and you have a little tap card, like a sort of subway card or credit card. And you go to this little kiosk and there's a grave there with an empty hole in the middle. And you tap your card and it goes boop, 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 boop. And it takes about 45 seconds to a minute for a robot to go retrieve your mother's ashes and shoot down the ashes. And it slides into the grave right in the hole with your mom's name on it. And you can light incense and just spend time in this little module, praying, talking to mom, being there. And it seems a little futuristic and a little cold, maybe.
Yeah.
But the fact is that people were having to travel hours outside of Tokyo to visit these grave sites, mm-hmm. and it takes too long.
Yeah.
And in Japan, it's really important that you visit the dead. And so if you're not visiting the dead, you're not doing it right, basically. So the fact that that's so modern and so centralized means that it's a busy place and people are interacting. And that's what cemeteries are supposed to be. That's what cemeteries were in America. The first cemeteries we had, people, the ones outside the city, people would go and have carriage races and picnics and just hang out in the cemetery.
Yeah.
And that's
they predate parks, don't they?
They do.
In many larger communities, they were the early version of what would become Central Park or
A lot of
public areas.
Most people don't know that the cemetery was the prototype for the big American urban park.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book, I guess there's another place in Japan with these light-up Buddhas. Explain that, because I found that really intriguing and so unbelievably Japanese at the same time.
It was one of my favorite places that I went on this whole tour of the world. And it's a columbarium, also a place they keep ashes. But here, it's 360 degrees, a big circle of light up LED Buddhas, crystal Buddhas, with the ashes behind them. And when you come in, you also have a little tap card that you tap and boop, 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 and it lights up your person, your Buddha, you know, your father or whoever, and it glows and pulses this white light on that Buddha, and then all the other Buddhas light up a different color. So it's like your dad is in focus, and you can go straight to him and say hi and pray and whatnot. And it's also a place where the monk who runs it is this incredibly – he looks like an old school monk. He's an older man with the robes. Exactly. But he's this remarkable innovator who every morning he goes and he types in the day that it is, you know, May 4th or whatever. And everybody who died that day starts glowing on the walls. Their Buddhas light up. Mm. And he sits there and he prays for them and he thinks about – technology and Buddhism and how we can combine those and create new death ritual and new places to keep the dead. And I was just, wow, this guy is a kindred spirit. I want to be just like this guy when I grow up.
Yeah, and that's important and kind of a comfort, I suppose, because in Japan, you have this aging population that doesn't have enough children to care for them. And the idea that at least someone would still remember you and pray for you after you're gone, even if you don't have any offspring, is probably a very comforting idea to many people.
It is. This priest, Yajima, his idea was these Buddhas are like your afterlife community. Mm-hmm. And they have this problem in Japan. They call it, I think it's Kotokushi, which is the lonely death, which means that you know, people don't find you for a while because you're older and you don't have any children. And you're not married, and they have crime scene cleanup people who specialize in these older people who just aren't found.
Oh.
And these are the type of people that if you have reserved a place in this Buddha place, they welcome you in after the cremation, and they pray for you every day, even though there's not anybody else who can pray for you.
You know, we were just talking about how Halloween is upon us, and along with that comes the Mexican Day of the Dead. I was interested in the evolution of the Mexican Day of the Dead over the past 50 years from something that was sort of frowned upon in Mexico and relegated to remote villages to this widely celebrated cultural event over just the past half century. I always thought that it was much more ingrained. How did Dios de los Muertos go mainstream in Mexico?
You know, I thought that too. I thought it was this very ancient tradition in Mexico, and it is. But at a certain point, it became something that people in the deep boonies practiced. And it was in places like Mexico City, which were these big modernized, slightly westernized cities, it was seen as superstitious and a place that people in rural areas did. And then at a certain point, Halloween, back to Halloween, came down and was infiltrating Mexico as a holiday as well. And all of these cultural critics in the 1970s were saying, wait a second, this is American version of a relationship with death. We have our own version of a relationship with death in Mexico, and we should be celebrating that. So over the next 30 years, even in big cities where they never really celebrated Dia de los Muertos, they're bringing it in and they're bringing and making it part of Mexican culture. And the most stunning example of this is when I first arrived in Mexico City for Dia de los Muertos, there was this huge parade right in Mexico City. That was the Dia de los Muertos parade, and it was just the most amazing spectacle you've ever seen. The skeletons dancing down the street and shooting cannons of confetti, and it was just incredible. And it turned out this was a parade that had also been featured in the most recent James Bond movie. And you would think Spectre,
right.
Yeah. And you would think that this big parade, you know, the producers had gone down, seen the parade, and wanted to put it in their movie. No. They had made it up for their movie, and then the Mexican government in Mexico City was like, oh, geez, we got to really make this parade.
Yeah.
People are going to think this is a thing in Mexico City. And so they spent something like a year and like 7,000 volunteers planning this massive spectacle parade to show. So it was James Bond. It was Hollywood that made this parade. But I do think that Mexico is really proud of this aspect of their culture, and they want to show the world that they have this colorful, beautiful, intimate relationship with death. And I think that just by how many people in America are trying to co-opt it a little bit, it shows how much we wish we had something like that.
Yeah, and you talk about the benefits of that intimate relationship with death. I think you even have a specific example of a friend of yours who I think she lost a baby and found some solace in reconnecting with these aspects of death in her own Mexican culture, like Dios de los Muertos and the paintings of Frida Kahlo. How did this help her grieving process?
So this is my friend Sarah Chavez, who is Mexican-American, grew up in East Los Angeles, and she'd always known about her Mexican heritage, but she wasn't allowed to fully practice it, as many, you know, immigrants to America really aren't. And she lost a child in a very tragic way, and she went down to Mexico for Day of the Dead the first time, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago, and was like, wait a second. Look at this. Everybody, you know, when we went to one of these big, beautiful cemeteries, there were people who had lost babies 20 years ago, but the grave was still fully decorated with candles and flowers and offerings. And they were sitting there and they were talking about their babies and showing pictures of their babies. And here in America, she wasn't allowed to talk about her child dying at all. It freaked people out. It bummed them out. It made them feel threatened about their own mortality. Nobody wants to hear about a child dying. But for the parents of these children, it's a tragedy because parents, when you have a child, you want to show off your child. I don't have any children, but I know enough about social media to know that what people want is to share this beautiful experience of having a child. But when you lose that child, it's like you just get cut off. You don't get to talk about the child. You don't get to speak its name if you no longer are a mother by our standards. And that's horrible. And so when she went to Mexico and saw how much people were accepting of the death of any human, and wanting to talk about it and wanting to keep up a relationship with the dead person publicly, that's what really changed things for her in her perception.
What do we lose here in America when we cut out all of these rituals that require us to interact with the body and cultural traditions that actually acknowledge and celebrate our ancestors?
Yeah, that's the core of what I do. I think we lose so much, and it's so heartrending because it's so easy to get back. It's right at the tip of our fingers. It's legal and safe to do all of these things. And yet we have a funeral industry and a culture that's acting as a gatekeeper and telling us not to do it. But I think that when you sit with a dead body, just a natural dead body, say back to the example of your mom dying under hospice care at home, not only do you get to see these little subtle changes in this woman that you loved and realize that she's dead and she's not coming back and you have to start your grieving process, you get to also think about your own mortality and the fact that you one day are going to die. And as this woman is dead, you too will be dead one day. And you also get to grieve for the world, humanity, everybody else that you didn't. It's this safe space to really think about death and grieve all the losses you didn't get to have this intimate relationship with. It's this sacred time, whether you're secular or deeply religious, and it should be respected. And we just aren't doing a good job of letting people know that that is available to them.
You say in the book that not everyone is supportive of the way you run your funeral home. You're something of a disruptor to the industry. Tell us how you operate differently. Let's say I come in with my dead relative and I'm grieving. What are my options? What do you say to me?
I like this idea of you coming in with just like over your shoulder or something.
Yeah.
Here's dad.
Yeah,
here
like
we go.
A sack of potatoes.
Yeah. Brought him in. Well, we start with the premise that you know what you want and you know what's best. We can suggest things, but we start with the premise that you are the driving force of what's happening. So if you want to just keep dad at home, we originally thought that we were going to do a lot more going into people's homes and helping them prepare the body in the home. Mm-hmm. We don't do that much because when you give people the knowledge and the permission, they just do it themselves. You might say,
really?
You know what? We'll tell you, hey, if your dad dies at home, you just give us a call whenever. You know, if you have any questions, by all means, call us. But until you're ready, and you might call us 3 hours later, you might call us 24 hours later, you might call us 2 days later. You just take the time you need. Invite people over, hang out, have a beer, talk about what a great guy dad was or what a shit dad was, you know, depending on how you feel about him. And that's on you. That's your personal choice. And then if you want to show up, we have a green cemetery that we partner with in Joshua Tree that does the natural burial we were talking about.
Right.
If you want to go in and you want to dig that dirt and put it right on the shrouded body.
Wow, you can
you
do that.
Yeah, absolutely. You're out in the desert and you're putting that dirt right on the body. If you want to show up at the cremation and push the button to light up the machine, we want you to
you
do that.
You have that right.
You have that right, and we encourage you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think just the thing that sets us apart is that we start with the idea that, yeah, we're the professionals. We have the licenses. We're legally allowed to offer this service, but you know what's best for your own family and for your own dead loved ones.
I have to ask then, how do you want to go when you die?
I think it changes. I always try and keep an up-to-date document on my computer of what I want. But right now, I would love just to practice what I preach and have a wake at home and then a natural burial.
Okay.
Just my body straight in the earth. The idea of decomposing and being food for worms, I find incredibly comforting. I think it's beautiful. I think it's, I'm not a religious person, so it's kind of my own religion, the idea of going back into the earth where I came from. And so, yeah, that brings me a lot of comfort.
Yeah.
And I'm not excited to die, but if I do die, I think that I would be pleased that that's how I went.
Well, there's one option that I don't think is allowed right now in America, but you say if you given your druthers, you would go for what's called a sky burial, right?
Yes,
or a sky funeral?
Yeah.
What is that?
If I really had what I wanted, I wouldn't even be buried. I would be laid out above the ground to be eaten by animals. Yeah. And that's a thing that they do in India. They do it in Tibet.
Yeah.
So it's happening right now. It's not like some ancient thing. But the idea of, you know, I don't eat a lot of meat now, but I used to eat all the meat, and I've eaten animals, and I'm an animal.
Back, circle of life.
Yeah, exactly. I'm an animal. I'm an organic creature on this planet, and when I die, I think we gotta, you know, pay it forward, give it back, and it's very visceral, the idea of, and we don't like to think of ourselves as animals. That's not a fun thing for humans, but if we want to talk about the reality of our planet and our cycle of life and our place in the universe, we have to acknowledge that we too are animals and that maybe we should not be locking our bodies up in fortresses underground, not anywhere near the earth around it, but that we go back and contribute.
Yeah, sky funeral sounds really nice. I mean, if you sell someone on the sky funeral option, ask, well, by the way, what is it?
Yeah, how do you go? Do you just shoot you up
apart
into the sky?
Vultures,
yes. Vultures eat you and carry you up into the sky.
Yeah.
Got it. You know, but again, cultural relativism. It depends on where you're from and how, you know, to someone in Tibet, the idea of putting you in a big industrial crematory is like, ugh, why would you do that when the vultures take your body into the sky? You know, so it's all where you're from and how you look at it.
I'm curious, is there any regulation that says I couldn't have a Viking funeral where they traditionally set you off in a boat and then set the boat on fire?
There's a couple problems with this.
Problem?
I don't want to burst your bubble here at the end, but the problem one is that that's really more of a Hollywood conception than real.
Oh, really? That's
real,
not a real
history.
Thing?
Not so much. I mean, there's some records of it being done, but it's not really the thing they traditionally did.
Okay.
And the second issue is that, you know, with a pyre, they continuously add wood throughout the process. So if you're just in like a dinghy, what happens is the boat burns up like that.
Yeah.
And then you have your half-charred body kind of bobbing around in the water. So it's not quite as romantic. But you know what? If you had, say you were cremated first, and then we could put your ashes on a boat and then set your, I know it's not as fun, but like you could still set something on fire, which is fun, and push that out. And then your ash, if you want to do a sea scattering, instead of scattering it, you set it out on a little flaming boat, and then the boat burns. You know, okay.
It's the Coast Guard. Isn't it the Coast Guard's problem at that point if it doesn't burn?
What we could do is we could build you a pyre on a boat.
Oh, okay.
So we'd have to, you know, it'd be hard, but.
Okay, this is complicated.
You know, I want you to live your death dream.
Well, before we go, I just have to ask this. This has been the burning question that's been on my mind since I started reading this book. In the movies, especially in war movies, they always talk about the stench of death. As a mortician, tell me, honestly, what does a real dead body smell like?
Okay, so a real dead body for the first 2 or 3 days, people always think a body's immediately decomposing after they die. Mm-hmm. They're not. You have a nice little period of time, especially if you put the body on some ice. You have a nice long time where it's totally fine and you can't even really, they just look kind of look like they're sleeping. You're fine.
Okay.
But if a body isn't put under refrigeration and isn't found for, you know, 3 or 4 days, decomposition is a smell that you do not forget. It's I describe it as like a bucket of orange peels and fish, like left out in the sun with some white wine on it. It's just this sickly sweet licorice-y.
Sweet,
really? Yeah, it's sweet, but not in a good way. Not in like a lollipop way. Like in a in a sickly, licorice-y. I mean, if you've ever walked by a dumpster and gotten that hit of that really sickly, sweet, rotting meat or fruit or garbage smell, it's kind of like that, except except a human. It's not my favorite part of the job, let's say that.
Does it smell kind of ammonia-y?
It can, but I think it's a very natural smell that we kind of put in. It's weird because you try and, at a certain point, it gets to the fridge or it gets to the morgue, and you're putting it in this sort of medicalized environment, but it's just this piece of rotting meat. Of course, it was a human, but at that point, nature has taken over, and it's this sort of...
Wow.
What a fun note to end on.
I was just going to say, you know, what a great thing for everyone who just listened to this podcast before they go to lunch.
You usually have such nice, normal people on your podcast.
Well, it's been a delight nonetheless. The book is called From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find Good Death. Caitlin Doty, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Want to try day trading the markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, now you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Thanks again to Caitlin Doty for coming on the podcast. Order her book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find Good Death on Amazon, or download the audiobook at audible.com. Check out her popular Ask a Mortician videos on YouTube. Visit CaitlinDoty.com for more information or orderofthegooddeath.com. And follow Caitlin on Twitter at TheGoodDeath. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. And please take a moment to take our listener survey at podsurvey.com/kick so we can get to know who's listening, and it's also helpful with our advertisers. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.